Welcome to Your Path to Nonprofit Leadership, the weekly podcast that will help you maximize your leadership role in the nonprofit sector. I'm your host, Patton McDowell, and I'm happy to give you ideas that can elevate your leadership role in your current or future nonprofit organization. Once again, I've got a great conversation to share with you this week, and it's with Carrie Botta, whose journey in nonprofit leadership includes senior fundraising roles in healthcare and at higher education institutions. She currently serves as the Assistant Vice Chancellor for University Development at North Carolina State University. And I think there are three particular headlines to listen for in my conversation with Carrie. Number one, the great examples of leadership in action that she and her senior colleagues pivoted around the COVID-19 situation, how they adapted. Certainly, there are lessons to take from that. Also, there are lessons that she learned from previous economic downturns. And what can every organization do as it reflects back on the difficult times of the 2008 economic downturn and even back to 9/11 and how organizations adapted from there. And Carrie will share some great examples. Also, I think Carrie lifts our spirits with positive outcomes that we can take from this COVID-19 situation. When we come out on the other side, perhaps there's some things that we will benefit from as a result of this reflection that we've all had as we've had to work from home. Don't forget to check out the show notes for this episode. Just go to the podcast or the news page at pattonmcdowell.com and you will find all of the resources. Carrie had some great books to offer to our library, and you can find out more about those with direct links and also find out more about the great work that Carrie is doing at NC State. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Carrie Botta. Carrie, thanks for joining me on The Path.
Thanks for having me, Patton. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm excited about this conversation, Carrie, because you've had a fantastic career in the nonprofit sector as a fundraiser, both in healthcare and higher ed. And I'm eager to hear about that journey. And as we'll talk more about, of course, in recent times, leadership in action. You know, so many senior leaders like yourself have had to adapt to a strange new world, and we'll talk about that. But before we get there, tell us, how did you come to the nonprofit path?
Well, that's a fun question. I think I've heard a lot of folks who spend a career in nonprofit say they fell into it or it just happened. And for me, it was really intentional. I wanted to make a difference and I wanted to help people in some way. And so I actually was working in direct care for a day hab facility and realized that that was not the best fit for me. So I actually worked with a headhunter. It was the 90s. That's kind of what you did. And, and got connected with the Muscular Dystrophy Association. And I immediately fell in love with doing something for a cause. And I loved that we were so connected to the patients in our chapter that we served. And I also learned the basics of fundraising, that it is a numbers game. So I would say that I got into it very intentionally and grew from there.
But it didn't take you long to realize this was something you were both passionate about and obviously very skilled at as well.
I think, I don't know that I realized that I was skilled at it. I think I realized that I was very self-driven and competitive, and I liked to exceed goals, and I understood that by exceeding them, I was directly impacting people who needed it. So that was what motivated me, yeah.
Well, I'm eager to learn more about your journey. You know, we'll talk about some of the things early on, because now, of course, those lessons you learned early, you're applying to folks that you're hiring and working with now as you manage a team. Before we get into that, we'll learn more about the volume of activity you deal with, Carrie, with the different individuals and units you supervise. How do you stay organized? What have been some of your tactics to manage a very fluid and fast-paced world?
Oh, that's a great question. I think sometimes I just let myself not be as organized as I'm comfortable with.
And I, right.
I, right volume just dictates it. But I think there's two things throughout my career. I've always surrounded myself with really great people in all different roles and allowed them to do what they do best. So if their job is to manage a calendar, then I don't mess with it. I let them do that. And if their job is to raise money, I let them do that. And so that keeps me focused on what I need to do. The other thing that I've done always, and I think this is helpful for a lot of people, is to keep lists. It seems simple, but my lists even have lists. I have a sticky note. I have a big list. I have the whiteboard in the office. And I think once that starts to feel disorganized, I realize I need to tighten it up and get some of the, you know, high priority things moving and off those lists.
Excellent. Well, again, I'm sure that has to come into play given all the things you're dealing with. And in fact, why don't you give our listeners an idea of the nature of your role? You've had a couple of positions at NC State University, but talk about the one you have now and the scope, if you will, and your team.
Sure. So I started as the Assistant Vice Chancellor for University Development just last August in 2019.
Right.
In that role, yeah, I came from the Wilson College of Textiles. I was there for about 2 years before, but it was an internal move, but it's a very, very different kind of landscape. So I went from being an executive director to having university development and several of the units around campus report up to me. So about half the teams I share with the associate vice chancellor for university development. And between the two of us, we're responsible for the fundraising program outside of principal gifts and what our vice chancellor and the chancellor are responsible for.
Yeah, lots of activity. So you're still maintaining kind of some frontline donor activity, but now in many ways coaching other people. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it is. And actually, I'm so much less of a player coach in this role than I've ever been in my career. It's more just a coach, which is the biggest transition. So I don't really have a portfolio at this point, which is, it's uncomfortable. And my ABC and I talk about it quite often that we need to let it evolve organically because there was a lot of infrastructure to be developed and built and some, you know, just basic reporting that people who have worked in other shops have had. And NC State was not late to the game with some of the high level fundraising, but certainly with some of the systems that support that. So we've been fortunate to be able to spend the time focusing on putting the systems in place that will help us do a better job raising more gifts. And it's been at the sacrifice of my, you know, portfolio. I do miss donor contact, though.
But ultimately, you're going to help create more donor contact, right, from the systems as well as the colleagues that you're helping develop.
Sure. And some of that's starting to happen already where, you know, we're seeing some good results. And at the same time, I'm fortunate because, you know, I'm at all of the events and our functions that we do, and I get to support my colleagues and coworkers in their events and, you know, meet the donors that way. And of course, there's the folks that I've met at the Wilson College of Textiles who I, you know, remain in contact with, but it's different than managing your own portfolio when your portfolio is kind of a range of different shops and each of them at NC State is very, very different from the other, both in their alumni profile and their, you know, their leadership, their volunteer leadership. Each of them has a different kind of look and feel and operation. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, and I can imagine the complexity, having spent some time in higher education myself, that you have to put on different types of hats as it relates to the different schools and colleges and programs and so forth. And so you're relatively recent in this new position, not new to campus, but new to this position. You're getting settled, getting processes in motion, and then all of a sudden a coronavirus hits. And yes. So I can only imagine the adventure that created, and I guess maybe share with us how was it on the senior leadership team? I guess the term that comes to mind is your triage. You've got so many things going on. How did you all first address and react to this situation?
That was pretty interesting because I actually I watched it unfold as much as I kind of helped support what, you know, what the different units would be doing. And a lot of it obviously comes from when you have, you know, governor mandated work from home. Well, there you go. But for a week before the work from home order happened, we started to transition and navigate through some of our different, like our central major gifts team had people that had been traveling. So our ABC said, if you've been traveling, you need to stay home for 2 weeks. And obviously they just never came back. We all ended up home. So I think it was a lot of communication, a lot of some people were more comfortable being in the office than others. And as we transitioned to work from home, we had to also prioritize what was getting canceled. So our work from home order came, you know, officially it was St. Patrick's Day on the 17th, and we had our day of giving scheduled for the following Wednesday, the 25th. So
wow.
Last year was our first day of giving. It was an enormous success, raising $13 million. And we had gone through a VIP window and everything that you do leading up to, you know, 8 days before the actual event. So a lot of our conversations in those early days were around, do you do a major campus and alumni event amid a crisis?
Right.
It was not an easy decision, but ultimately we made the decision to postpone it, and we're still discussing what and when Day of Giving will look like. And part of that, Patton, is because we had to immediately pivot into that emergency fundraising. So certainly we're not the Red Cross, but this all happened during spring break. And we had students that were, you know, out of the country, or students that were in the country and had housing challenges. And so our student emergency fund, we ended up getting a really large gift from a great university donor for $500,000, and we're at just about $1 million now. We'll probably announce in the coming week or so that we've hit that milestone for student emergency needs. And the number of grants that had gone out, it was being tracked daily.
Wow.
So we jumped from, you know, the frying pan of getting ready and preparing our entire team and campus for Day of Giving and you know, regular duties as assigned, to we're not doing that and we've got to pivot.
Well, and I take it, I was going to ask you the donor response. Obviously there has been great support, I'm assuming, from alumni and donors. And I guess, were you sensitive in your outreach, or was there discussion about how aggressively you should fundraise?
Lot of discussion. We have a really gifted communications team. And again, our chancellor and vice chancellor are very skilled at handling, you know, this kind of crisis communication and taking the temperature of our different groups. We have a lot of volunteer leadership. We had varying opinions, and certainly we had some donors reach out and say, please do Day of Giving. We need something positive. And I think, you know, they understood that we had to take the path that we took, because more than, you know, people here, it would feel differently to do a Day of Giving in Raleigh than it would, say, in New York or LA.
Right. Well, but I'm glad ultimately, so there's still decisions to be made as this coronavirus unfolds, and that it becomes an ongoing discussion for you all to determine when is appropriate, right, to continue.
Yeah, I think you could apply that to all of our work at this point, Patton, and I'm sure you're feeling the same way. And, you know, my colleagues who do this, where in the beginning, we didn't know. Every day it was another conversation, because we weren't sure what was coming down the pike and how quickly things were going to progress. And then we weren't sure how long the stay-at-home order was going to last and what that would look like. So I would say it kind of happened in three different phases, you know, that ramping up, then we're working from home and basically changing the structure and the nature of our program, right? We stopped being frontline fundraisers, you know, with less than 18 months left in our campaign, and started being kind of crisis communicators and technology experts. I mean, we
good point.
A 93-year-old woman on a Zoom call. So
wow,
it's amazing what you can do when you try. So we were able to, you know, pivot and do that pretty quickly, and then had to say, okay, how do we make this completely not normal, but how do we become effective and move from response to proactivity in the phase that we're in right now?
It's a great question. And I'm sure you are pivoting nicely. In fact, I think maybe you were at Stony Brook, right, Carrie, during the last kind of significant economic downturn. Were there lessons from that experience that you brought kind of to your current role?
Sure. I was at Stony Brook starting in 2007. And so it was brand new, and the program was brand new, and we were really just trying to build something from nothing. I mean, when I say something from nothing, when I said, I want to raise money for the Heart Center, they said, what area are you interested in? I said, Heart Center and emergency room. So I went to research and said, could you pull a list of donors who have given $5,000 or more over the last 5 years? And there were zero.
Oh, wow.
And then I was like, well, could you lower that to like 1,000? And there were zero. So I started with, being able to build relationships internally and start with building a grateful patient program and trying to look at it that way. And over that time we used, what I guess was cover, right? The cover of a down economy to just build relationships and get the word out about what was happening.
It paid off in terms of just cultivating relationship as opposed to soliciting as much?
It did. You know, it was a very different place than NC State. We didn't have a name and in the community, and we didn't have a reputation. People didn't know us that way, and they didn't know the level of expertise and research that was happening there. So it's a really great opportunity for us to kind of connect in the truest sense of the relationship building. Let us just tell you what we're doing. So it did pay off. And over the next couple of years, despite sustained state cuts, we were able to figure out how to add team members. And we did it just one person at a time, kind of slogging through the process. We used to say we were like chickens scratching in the dirt. And
right.
And we did it because there was a great need, but there was also a really great product, for lack of a better word. I mean, our national and international reputation was better than the local one. And so that was almost an easy fix.
But your selling point there, Carrie, was just the investment in this personnel, even at a difficult time, clearly had a long-term horizon that was going to be very positive. Or is that how you sold it?
Yeah, I think we had to demonstrate some success, which we did. And then I think we built our own credibility through that success. And then honestly, we brought in some external help to share examples of what some of our counterparts were doing. And then you get a couple of, brand new attendings who've worked at Hopkins, who worked at the Cleveland Clinic, and who are some young and rising researchers. And they were used to doing this. And so they were the ones to influence, I think, their peers and the folks in the department. It was really helpful for us. And we had a leader, a great leader at the time, who completely believed in it and understood that it was an influenceable revenue stream. So we had to do our work. We had to do our homework. But the hospital margin is a tough one. Education.
Yes.
Same way. And there's only a few ways to get new money, and fundraising is one of them.
And I think that's such a good leadership lesson, Carrie, for nonprofits. I mean, everyone is understandably concerned about their positions, their jobs. But you make a good point that we shouldn't necessarily retreat from our staffing, particularly on the advancement or fundraising side, because these positions could be critical to the success of the organization getting through this crisis.
Well, I mean, that's a great point. It's certainly something that we look at, in a decentralized environment like NC State, when you think about what's coming down the pike and how will that impact us. We have our central team, and then we have, the different units and colleges around the university, and they're funded all in different ways, right? Some at the college level, some through different fees. There's all different ways of paying for positions in a complicated environment. And I saw the same thing at Stony Brook and also at the health system that I worked at. And I'm happy that we're not in a place where the first thing that you look at is communications and development to reduce.
Right. Because
that was the case in, 2007 through, the early part of the last decade, I'd say. With some of the small community hospitals, it seemed to be the only way that they would be able to, protect some of their budget was by reducing what they would consider their ancillary functions. But those are the same exact ones that keep people coming in the door and help you support your mission.
Right. Yeah, important point. And I hope I will certainly echo that as organizations, I think, frankly, are going to have to do some rapid strategic planning. And boards of directors of nonprofits, of course, are going to ask for scenario planning of how we manage what might be diminished revenues. But your point's a good one. We need to stand up for those folks that are critical to the kind of frontline revenues.
Yeah. And some of the things that we're doing now, I guess, to prepare for that, my ABC's lived through probably one more of these than I have. And he has started to take a look at during the last two economic downturns, the difference in, major giving and annual giving. And when you take a look at it over 7 years, it's really, it's a blip. It really right. doesn't change too much. I mean, it hurts and it feels like it's never going to end and that you won't come out of it. And I don't even think that we've approached it yet. We're going to meet our goal this year. Things are looking, really, really great at NC State. I have no concern about how we're going to end this year. It's just next fiscal year, the one beyond that we start worrying about.
Yeah, that's where I think the longer term scenario is the one that is of concern. But I like where you're going in terms of we've got to rally the troops now. And, I know you've had to adapt both internally with your boards to new communication strategies. We've all had to go to a virtual meeting environment, but you made a fascinating point to me that perhaps some of your boards and board members might enjoy this new Zoom environment. Do you see that changing the dynamic of meetings both internally and externally going forward?
I do. I think it will. I think people have really embraced this as an alternative way of connecting. I think it will never take the place, of meeting live. I think back to the first week where everybody was like, wow, this is great. And now 4 weeks into it, they just want to sit across the table from a human, right? So
right.
it's
right.
never going to replace us being live. However, I think there are some folks where it's tough for them to go from Charlotte or Arkansas to NC State or from New York to NC State to come for a meeting however many times a year. And so this makes it actually much more convenient and, it helps to manage their time better. The other thing that we're seeing is people moving towards kind of electronic consent agendas. It's not new for some boards, but for others, it's a very new concept to try and do the review in the business beforehand and then move to strategic conversations and matters that really need to be covered with a conversation live. So I think we're seeing, that half day and in some cases full day board meeting be reduced to 2 hours of very dense content with room for a good follow-up conversation. And I think we'll start seeing more of that moving forward, whether it's, an augmented meeting in the middle of the cycle or replacing a meeting with that. I could see that, happening moving forward.
That's such a good point, Carrie. And perhaps that's a silver lining element to this current situation. It's a chance to step back and reevaluate meetings, right? And your point is we probably should be thinking about that anyway. The strategic content of our agendas is what is most important. And it sounds like the virtual environment has kind of forced you to condense some of these discussions into what is actually strategically important. So maybe that is a holdover after we come back to live meetings.
I think certainly, we have, like I said, 13 different units around campus, and one of them has, more than a dozen of its own volunteer leadership groups, boards and councils and such. And so I think it's safe to say that there will be some measure of change and adoption of new technology as we move forward, but it certainly isn't going to replace our board meetings. Right. But to your point, Patton, about the reevaluation, I think that is one of the most positive outcomes that we'll have from this experience is our ability to really reassess some of our programming, some things that we've been questioning, why are we doing this? And is this really effective? We're going to have to prove that it is worthy or effective before we actually put it back into what could be a reduced budget moving forward.
Well, let me get that straight, because I think that's a great point. And so are there events perhaps that you've kind of always done, like every organization, there's some things we do just because we did it last year. Is this now an opportunity maybe to truly evaluate certain special events?
Yeah, so I think special events are one of them. I think, you know, obviously not talking about athletics. That's, you know, a hornet's nest. I'm not.
Right.
But certainly our special events, our engagement events, just the way that we have operated, there's nothing like shutting it all down at once to make you really take a look at what should we be doing? Which of these things were effective? And I think the times that you have to evaluate that is when you have a new leader in your organization. But in an organization like NC State, that doesn't ever happen at the same time. And with our, like I said, decentralized format, this is really an opportunity for all of us in university advancement to be looking at how we can do this very efficiently and effectively moving forward.
Well, and speaking of moving forward, you alluded to, fortunately, you feel relatively good about this year's kind of fundraising activity, the strategic planning for perhaps the current fiscal year. A lot of questions I'm getting and having conversations about, how do you do strategic planning going forward with so many unknowns? Have you all started to kind of put your head around that for, I guess, what amounts to next fiscal year, or is it too early really to put much detail into long range planning?
Oh goodness, I think it's never too early to, you know, to plan. And I think even when the environment is uncertain, there's certain things that you have to make decisions on, right? Like we didn't know what we were doing with Day of Giving, whether we were going to try and have it in June or we were going to move it to next fiscal year. But the whole purpose of the meeting that we called was to make a decision we could live with. Right. So we still don't know what we're going to do, but we knew we weren't going to do it before the end of the fiscal year. So I think we're going to have to continue to take that long and short approach and have flexibility. But we are looking at goal setting much more strategically than we have, where we have a set of performance standards and we'll have our financial goals that we're going to wait as long as we possibly can and do a combination of, you know, pipeline and 3-year averages with factoring out, you know, the big outlier gifts. There's really no secrets to how you do it. I think the timing of it though, and then what our intelligence from our gift officers tells us is how we're going to be able to predict for that. And the other thing is when you take a look at, again, performance during the last two downturns,
it's been relatively stable.
There's dips, but you can kind of calculate it. I'm sure that we could use some sort of mathematical model to project what we'll raise over the next 2 or 3 years based on how things went in the past.
That's a great point. And a lot of nonprofits, large and small, unless they are really new, could look back at similar figures for their kind of trends of fundraising around 2007, 8, 9, and even back to 9/11, I guess, if that were another significant kind of economic factor for their charitable giving. But great advice there, Carrie, on that point. And, you know, you mentioned your gift officers and the intelligence gathering. Obviously, it's a new world for them. They can't be on the road. They're not having contact. Are you seeing opportunities for other professional development? Not that we have to be sitting at home, you know, constantly cramming new information into our brains, but have you seen kind of new elements arrive as this environment's changed?
That's a great question. We have seen, well, I think so many of our partners have done such a great job of compiling information. And, you know, there's webinars on what are other people doing. There's all kinds of groups. I've participated in a few things, and we've actually had to start a Google document to kind of catalog what people are learning. And then there's a weekly email that our talent management is sending out with just a one-stop shop for what's available that week through some of our, you know, partners and consulting firms that are, you know, around. So yes, we are using it for professional development, but honestly, our gift officers are still doing gift work. We, you know, in the month of March, closed $7+ million gifts, and you know, half that month is obviously impacted potentially by this. Mm-hmm. So things are changing, certainly, and I don't think April will look like March looked, but March was business as usual, except virtually for the most part. And we had a couple of gift officers who were successful at doing some discovery work. Somebody connected with somebody in Iowa on a Zoom call and had a really great visit that way. Hadn't been able to get in touch with them beforehand. So we're finding that our alumni are happy to hear from us, and our donors are really grateful that we're checking in on them and trying to just be mindful that this isn't a time to kind of shy away, that it's a time to really lean towards the people that have been the closest to us and let them know, number one, what we're going through, and number two, what we're doing about it.
That's such a great point, and not the time to shy away. And those relationships you've been building, there's no reason you shouldn't be giving them just as much attention right now. I'm glad to hear you reinforce that. Well, Carrie, let me talk about in your role managing the talented fundraisers in the organization in which you work. What are the characteristics of the best ones? What are you seeing those? I mean, clearly there's a numeric bottom line to a fundraiser success, but I wonder, as you think about some of the very good ones you have around you, what makes the good ones so effective?
I think the same thing. So there's so many different styles and ways of fundraising and types of different fundraiser. But I think focus is the one thing that they have in common. And it's really focus on the donor and focus on really making that connection with the donor. So I'm thinking of two gift officers in mind. One is very, very driven. They're both very driven, but one of them is very organized, calculated, methodical. The other is much more intuitive and uses relationships and kind of strategic leveraging of relationships. And both of them are phenomenally successful, but it's kind of fun to work with the different personalities. I'd say focus is a big thing. And I think attitude is tremendous. I think if you have a terrible attitude, it doesn't matter how good you are at finding the right donors and making connections, you're not going to have a long career at a place.
Great point.
Yeah.
Well, are you seeing more of the current students, the in young alums considering advancement work, nonprofit work? What are the trends that you perhaps are seeing on your own campus?
We are, you know, I love that we have a case resident, and then we made a similar position to that last year because we had such great success. And it's a really good way to, you know, introduce a young professional who's interested in nonprofit and philanthropy to what it looks like to be a fundraiser, whether they start in annual giving or as a LAG officer, or they do, you know, administrative support work or some writing and digital content. We've definitely made good use of case residents, and we've hired them after the fact. We're seeing young people, especially this generation, who really want to make a difference and are excited about doing that, many of them at their alma mater. So we have several of our team in annual giving and around campus are alums and are just completely passionate about being on the other side of it now. They love it, and they're really, really great ambassadors for us.
Well, it sounds like you give them great opportunities, because I assume it, the advice you would offer if one of them walked up to you and said, "Hey, I like what you do, Carrie, and when you know someday I'd like to be in a position like yours," is that the kind of advice you would give, just to simply keep them engaged on campus or in other settings?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'd probably ask, you know, why? What is it? What? Because I like to kind of weed out the people who think that it's very glamorous and fun, right? Like they see
and, yeah, it's not all fun and games, is it?
Right. They see, you know, the Wilson College of Textiles gets named and wow, what a fun party that was. And if they don't understand the real kind of behind the scenes works that it takes to get to that point and the follow-up that happens after it. And, you know, for every Wilson family who's incredible to work with, there are 1,000 other phone calls and meetings and emails that need to get done, to make connections. And it's not glamorous, but it is fun if that's what you care about.
Good point. But those high profile situations may be more the exception, and you really do have to roll up your sleeves, right? And in a sense of being overall success.
Yes. Yeah.
As you think back on your journey, Carrie, you mentioned early on you had some great bosses. Were there any of the lessons you learned early or in the middle stages of your path to nonprofit leadership that were particularly helpful?
Yes, I think I learned that you don't have to be an expert to manage somebody who has expertise in that area. And that you need to hire good people and then let them do their job. And yeah. I think my best example is that I'm not an attorney, but, you know, gift planning reports to me, and I'm lucky that we've got a couple of attorneys and a CPA, and I don't know how to do what they do, but I do know how to build and grow that program.
Yes.
So I did learn that from a couple of good leaders. I also, you know, in my time, just like many others, learned kind of what not to do. And I think that individual approach, right? It's not a one size fits all thing. And that is starting to, I would say, serve me better in this role where we have all different units with all different priorities and challenges. And, you know, even though the common themes are the same, talent management, leadership, right, sourcing of prospects, their experiences are all different. And what works for one won't, you know, work for another.
Great point. Hey, have you found any particular professional development resources helpful? It sounds like you're fortunate on campus to have access to great information. I just wonder, for you personally, have you been one that has found certain resources most helpful?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love Patton's podcast.
Thank you for that shout out. Unprompted, of course.
Yeah, I'm serious though. I do think podcasts are a really great way to consume information right now because you can do it in short bits. And honestly, that's all I have time for these days with just everybody has a lot on their plate, and I don't have the attention span for, you know, 3 days worth of workshops. I think that conferences are really good team building, recruiting, networking experiences, and you get a nugget here or there. I think presenting at them makes you better. But there are a couple of things, you know, through my career, I've read Good to Great more than once, and I think it's interesting to see how it can be applied differently depending on where you are. Jim Collins has a really great suite of books, and I transitioned at one organization from Good to Great to Built to Last.
Yes, right.
It's kind of fun to say, wow, we've actually done this. It's time to, you know, lean up even a little bit more. Of course, you know, Lean In had a great impact on me. I was a vice president in a community hospital and the only female at the time around the leadership table and 8 months pregnant. And I listened to that in the car every day on my way to work. And it was,
wow.
I thought it was helpful. It was impactful.
That's Sheryl Sandberg. Is that right?
It is. Yeah. 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 And I think probably particularly relevant right now would be David and Goliath. Malcolm Gladwell has another, you know, great author and suite of books. And David and Goliath, I think, was a good reminder that when you have something like a state institution with a state-supported budget and, you know, multiple layers, you can use what is perceived as a weakness to be a strength. And for NC State, that could be our brand. But for you know, another university or small shop, what looks like it could be a weakness can sometimes be turned into a strength. And I think right now we have that opportunity with, you know, time to pause and take stock and really let's move forward doing what matters.
Well put, Carrie, very well put. And these books you have lifted up certainly are worthy of our respective bookshelves. Thank you for offering those suggestions. I guess any other advice you would offer? You know, your journey has been a successful one, and I really appreciate your sharing some of the lessons you've learned. I wonder anything else you'd offer to someone who's considering joining us on the path.
Well, thank you. I really do appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this. And I think, you know, it's a combination of how hard you work. I say it's the trying to find the balance between if you always do what you always did, you always get what you always got.
That's and great. Yes.
If at first you don't succeed, try again. So I think it just speaks to, it might not have worked then, but it'll work now. And that's, you know, Adam in our annual giving office had that experience with Day of Giving. It didn't work for 3 years in a row. He couldn't get the traction, but when he did, absolutely, it worked. So I would say, don't give up. Maybe the timing is just not right. And the other thing I would say is that we get a lot of criticism for there being turnover in development, and
right.
the life expectancy of a gift officer being 2 years. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of challenges in development and trying to do more with less. But the industry has changed so much, and our profession is so much more respected even than when I started. And there's a lot more to it. You can get a degree in it now. I don't think you could in 1997.
Right. Yep.
So I would say my advice would be to check it out and to enjoy it, enjoy the process. And when somebody asks you to do something, just say yes.
Great advice, Carrie. Words of wisdom to finish on. I'm grateful for your conversation, and thank you again for joining me on the path.
Thanks, Patton. Have a great day. Thank you for everything.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Carrie as much as I did and came away with practical ideas and advice that can help you with your professional journey, perhaps those of your colleagues and teammates, and for your organization in general. Don't forget to check out the show notes available on our website, pattonmcdowell.com, where you can find out more about all of the things Carrie and I discussed, in particular, the great books she noted at the end of our conversation. As always, thanks for sharing this episode with someone else on the path. And if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe. Go to the podcast page also at pattonmcdowell.com. And you'll see links to all the primary podcast platforms. Thanks again for all you're doing in the nonprofit sector and for the important work you're doing for causes that are most meaningful to you. I'll keep bringing you this content that can help you do it even better. Have a great week, and I'll see you next time on the path.